Hello, and welcome to Openly Gamer Theater's Tower of the Ape, a Savage Worlds Deluxe roleplay drama from the producers of Gamer's Table. Be warned, this production may contain some explicit material that may not be suitable for all audiences.
This is Dan. I'm going to be playing Matadai.
This is Shannon, and I'm playing Lovaisa.
Hi, this is Dave, and I'm playing Ronyos.
Hello, my name is Jason. I'm playing Odored Soractus.
And I'm Sean. I'm playing Mofir.
White canvas sails bulged in the wind like fat-bellied gods lording over the deck of the Kamar as her crew scurried below. Bare-chested seamen climbed the rigging with ease, gripping taut lines with brawny hands and between toes of naked feet. It reminded Rinyard of time he spent in southern Kush, where strange creatures scampered amid the dense canopy using hands, feet, and tails. He leaned forward against the portside bulwark, stiff wind tossing his curly black locks as the stout cargo ship cut through the deep azure waters of the inner sea with surprising quickness. Sparing a glance starboard, he noted that Ronyos, his Zamorian companion, was idly chatting with Lobaiza, the white gold-haired Northron, the sight of whom caused the Poitanian to gnash his teeth in frustration. Both seemed content with each other's company, which Rinyard disregarded, so long as their actions didn't do anything to further complicate their journey. Ronyos was fairly direct. It was the woman that concerned him. She had a knack for stirring up problems. Problems that he had to solve. Rinyard already had a person in his life that fit that description. He was very sure that he did not need a second. His head turned to the prow, to where his darkly dressed companion Valak sat. As usual, he was alone. The hood of his flapping black cloak was down, exposing his thin, coal-black hair. The man reclined on a massive coil of coarse rope, staring directly ahead as if focusing on some distant point in the water. The Poitanian then turned his attention to the raven-haired first mate, barking orders to the crew in well-seasoned short bursts. A thick-armed, barrel-chested bosun glowered at the deckhands as he stood beside the officer.
As I stand there, I will watch to see if there's anyone worthy of my attention.
You mean like sizing them up?
Yeah, size them up.
All right. Do you speak Harkanian?
I do, but I'll not let on that I do. If there's no one of interest, I'll just listen to the sailors.
Okay.
you start overhearing conversations from the sailors. At first, they're all business, but as it settles down and it's not quite as hectic, and some of the guys are just kind of standing around or watching for when the bosun walks by and then, you know, just kind of leaning against a mast, catching a break or something. And you're standing there and they're talking around you after they think that you don't speak their language. Just like most people who kind of realize that people, the person around them can't speak the same language, they just...
Talk about them?
Either talk about them or say things that maybe they shouldn't.
Brignard turned his attention to a whispered conversation near him. Two black-bearded seamen speak to a third, quite a few years their junior. It's the younger man's enthusiasm that catches his ear, as well as the hisses from his companions as his voice grows too loud.
Oh, who cares? He doesn't understand us. Even if he could, I am not concerned. He has shown no love for the captain, especially after he took all of his coin.
The men whisper to each other for a bit before emotion takes over again.
Symok's last crew all perished when they went to that island.
Lies. Father, you believe anything you're told.
It is true. Try speaking to Bakai about it.
And get a cracked head. No, thank you.
Gusting of wind obscures the conversation, and Rinyard considers abandoning his idea altogether, until...
You know what troubles me? How come none of the crew have seen what is kept in the hold? Huh, Golam? Not one of the crew.
Means nothing.
I have served on dozens of slave ships. Dozens. Never has one hid all the slaves away like this one.
Milos doesn't pay for spoiled stock.
Perhaps Symok is just protecting his investment. Milos, you believe that myth? Look here, boy. There is no king of the slavers. Those strange masked gods. What are you on about, Golam? That is what troubles me. Those strange gods, with their ghastly golden masks.
I haven't heard one of them speak.
Oh, and you're around them all the time, are you?
Malak, the stouter of the two bearded men, pulls a pipe from a pouch at his waist and begins stuffing it with rich black tobacco as the younger man, Fava, procures a tinderbox. Lighting the pipe and passing it around, the crewmen begin their discussion anew.
You already determined that there's a bit of a dissension amongst the crew. And then the other thing that you take note of is that quite a few of them start talking about the saucy little tart that's on board. And they're not talking about the big, huge bitch. Nadia is probably one of the most beautiful women any of these dudes have ever seen.
She is like something out of a dream. I saw her when she and the little one stepped onto the deck yesterday.
You would know what to do with her, boy. You have no business with that woman.
She stays in her cabin all day and night. It would not be hard to steal down there and see her. Just one more time.
Do more than see her, I'll wager. She is a passenger on this ship, protected by the captain and her companions. I do not fear any of them. I could slit all their throats in their sleep and have my way with any one of those girls. Keep talking so loud and we'll all be flogged. I, for one, am getting back to work before...
A harsh cry silences them, and they scatter like startled quail as the brawny-armed bosun stamps towards them.
I'll linger a bit longer. Then I'll make my way below to the cabins.
Okay.
Or the main room outside the cabins.
Okay.
Is there a book or something that I can read?
Sure. We can say that Ronios procured a Zamorian text for you to learn the language from.
I will lounge outside the cabins in the main room.
Are you remaining there for the rest of the day?
Waiting to see if anyone sneaks down to get to Nadia or the girl.
Watching Rinyard eavesdrop on the witless seaman near him amused Ronios, who lazed against the mainmast. As nonchalant as the swordman attempted to be when he made his way toward the cabins, Ronios read him quite easily. It was obvious that he heard something that disturbed him, to the point where he felt his presence was needed elsewhere. Ronios grins. Rinyard was not a complicated man. Beneath the cocksure and aloof veneer, there was the loyalty and protectiveness of a hound. And that is exactly what the Poitanian really was, a well-trained dog. The Zamorian crosses his arms and looks up at the girl sharing the shade of the thick mast with him. If Rinyard was a guard dog, Lovaisa was a she-panther. He liked to think that he understood the white gold-haired Aesir, especially with all the time that they had spent together, but in truth, she was alien to him. Her aspiration to rescue her father from the clutches of the slaver Milos was easy to understand. What confounded him was her manner. In many ways, Lovaisa was like a child. He found her ignorant innocence charming at times, infuriating at others. More than once he had to pacify her after a playful jibe was misinterpreted, or some other slight that she perceived spurred her to a murderous frenzy. The Aesir stood there next to him with a stern intensity that he found comical. Only a snow-brained root would find the minutiae of such a simple sea voyage so utterly fascinating. Yet there she was. watching every action of the sailors as if there was some hidden meaning behind it. He nudges her booted foot with his elbow, and she turns her hard eyes down to him. He smiles a wide, toothy grin. It was unfair of him to unleash his full arsenal of Zamorian seductive arts on her, so he settled for a half-grin that regularly made younger women flush. It took a moment before he realized that she was not impressed with his charms. It seems that no amount of heat could warm the ice in her veins. Rejection was not something that he was accustomed to, and no son of Shivatas would give up such a game so easily. The long play, then. Changing tactics, Ronyos tilts his head in an inquisitive fashion, lips thinning and brow wrinkling in a well-practiced look of concern. She eyes him for a moment, and then turns her attention back to the crew.
Ronyos, it's weird. There's a whole bunch of guards here.
What do you mean, a whole bunch of guards?
There's one guarding the captain's quarter, and two guarding the hold. I'm kind of curious as to why they are here.
Yes, I am too. Where is this captain's quarters? Which direction?
That-a-way.
That-a-way? That-a-way? You can't give me left, right, up, down? You just that-a-way? This is what I get?
Where was it?
It was at the rear of the ship.
It's at the rear of the ship.
It's at the rear of the ship. Thank you.
The Aesir's eyes bore into his, and he gulps uncontrollably. Another case of playful banter mistaken for insult. When will she learn that that is the way of the civilized? Not every slight needs to be resolved with violence.
Okay, look, I tell you what. I go see if I can find out what is behind this door.
Okay, good. I didn't want to get into any further trouble since I did just kill a prince.
Yes, yes, that is appreciated.
I'm trying to lay low.
Try not to kill anyone else before I get back, okay?
I make absolutely no promises about that.
Oh, good.
Ronyos gathers his feet under him and rises with casual ease. Then, with the dispassionate grace of a cat, he saunters toward the aft of the Kamar. Swiftly, he climbs the steps of the aft castle to the raised poop deck where the pilot stands like a statue, holding the wheel beside a gathering of crewmen, including Symok, who seems to be the only one noticing Ronyos, a tilting of his broad-brimmed hat being the only indication of acknowledgement.
The pilot is kind of talking about his job and what he's doing and how important his job is. You haven't seen him move the wheel once.
Buddy, you're driving a boat.
He's holding it steady. That's his job. But he's talking about how great and important his job is. And he just kind of goes on and mm-hmm. on and on about it. And he's not paying any attention to you. He's just talking because he has somebody to talk to at this point. You notice that any of the crew that were on the poop, as this guy starts talking, go away. And now you're up there by yourself with him. And no one's paying attention to you. Go ahead and make your agility check to hop back and take a peek in the window.
8.
The 8 explodes.
8 again.
Keep rolling it.
4.
So
20.
20.
Absently nodding to the banter of the pilot, Ronyos slowly backs towards the bulwark, placing his hands behind him and grabbing the rail above the barrier. Timing his action with the heave of the ship, the Zamorian uses his hands to support him as his steel spring muscles fire, and he jumps backward over the railing and quickly scampers down the stern like a spider. The lead-lined windows of the captain's cabin stood open, making a child's play for Ronyos to position himself upside down to peer inside. His head barely cleared the upper edging of the window before he had to withdraw it. Inside the room was a young boy that Ronyos hadn't seen thus far during the journey. He knew that some sea captains took on boys to attend them, so that was not unusual. The lad had stood stock still, staring at the closed door of the cabin as if instructed not to move until his master's return. Lowering his head and ignoring the queer child, the quick eyes of a master Zamorian thief told Ronyos that the room bore more than a prepubescent boy. It contained riches. Decadent opulence greeted his eyes as he focused on every detail. Thick satin pillows lined a heavily padded bed. The gilded chairs around the small chart-covered table are cushioned in azure velvet.
Doesn't match the rest of the ship.
Yeah, the rest of the ship is very utilitarian. There's not a whole lot of gilt or anything in the rest of the ship. You also see two distinct treasure chests in here that are closed and locked.
Okay.
Right next to each other, just on the inside of the door.
This guy apparently built everybody.
And you see that there's maps on the table, and you see that there's compasses and whatnot are on there. And he had been doing some sort of navigation before he went out and started yelling at the crew.
So there's a lot of treasure in there that we could use.
Possibly.
Okay, so I'm going to...
Well, and the other thing you see is on top of one of the chests, you see the bag that Rinyard handed the captain to pay for your way sitting right on top of one of the chests.
Cool. All right, well, then I'm going to pull myself back up by my toes.
No roll? It's like, you roll a 15 and then a 20. This would be a perfect opportunity for him to fall in the water.
Yes, roll.
Oh, shit.
Strength check.
Oh, shit.
Two ones. That's a botch.
Sounds like a Benny time.
Yeah, I'm going to Benny that. Six and a five.
So reroll the six. So an eight. All right. So, yes, you pull yourself up over the top rail and turn around just as the pilot turns around and he says, "That's about all I got." And then he turns back around and now he's quiet.
That was incredibly interesting. Thank you. I'm going to under off now.
Ronyo's strolling in his usual manner. Lovaisa stands where he left her, at the mainmast, eyeing him expectantly, but he says nothing. He simply passes her and continues towards where he knew that Valak rested. The strange man lays on a massive coil of rope, idly staring past the bowsprit. Judging by the distant look on his face, Valak was lost in thought again, no doubt obsessing over his lost treasure. Clearing his throat, Ronyos catches Valak's attention, though the latter's attempt at masking his surprise didn't fool the trained eye of the Zamorian. Ronyos nods to Valak, who looks at him from the corner of his eye, then turns his attention back to his brooding.
Ronyos?
Listen, I have something to tell you. I looked through the windows, down off the side of the ship, into the captain's room. Something's not right on this ship. The captain's quarters don't match the rest of the ship. It's not right. It's very, very decadent, and it's got all kinds of velvet, and there's it's filled with treasures. There's treasure chests and the money bag that we gave him before we got on the boat. It's sitting right on top of the treasure chest.
Wow.
But, I mean, just everything in there is very gold and shiny.
At least we know where it all is now, don't we?
Well, it's not anywhere else on this ship. It's all in that room. But I want to know why that room looks so different from the rest of the ship.
Because Captain Bilks-a-Lot.
His name's Captain Bilks-a-Lot?
That's just the name I gave him.
Oh.
The eyes of the Aesir burned as she contemplated throwing the worthless Zamorian over the side of the ship. She knew that the man was cautious by nature. She still did not see the need for him to be rude to her. Though she had been among civilized men for a time, their ways still exasperated her. This was especially true of Ronyos. If she didn't consider the Zamorian a friend, she'd have split his skull a long time ago. Her ire rising, she abandoned her shaded spot and stalked toward him as he chatted with Valak. Seeing her approach, Ronyos nodded to Valak and closed the distance between her, stopping at the capstan to gaze at something that suddenly caught his attention.
Ronyos, did you find anything?
Yes, I went and I looked through a window and I found nothing. I'm not sure why he's got the room guarded like that, but it's all empty. Bare walls, there's not a damn thing in there. He barely has a bed.
Interesting.
I think it's time for a bullshit roll.
Yeah, can I see if he's lying? Like,
you know how you tell if a Zamorin is lying? His lips are moving.
He's got a couple of crates set up with a blanket on top of that. It appears that's what he sleeps on. There's a bucket in the corner. I assume that's what he uses for a toilet.
Yeah, just make a smarts roll. What'd you get?
Three.
All right. It's not, you don't know much about ship's captains or why they would lock things up, but, you know, you're looking around at this crew, and, you know, they've been kind of watching you and even watching the little girl, and you're like, well, maybe he just wants to keep these Cretans that work for him away from his stuff. It makes sense. Maybe he's got some
privacy issues
or whatever. You know, so it doesn't make sense, maybe, but you can't find any error in logic because you've never been on a boat before.
Okay.
My take on all this is that I know he's got the money. I gave it to him. Plus, the guards could be guarding weapons for the crew.
Yes, but you are also a man of civilization, and that would make sense to you.
What about the hold, Ronyos? Did you find anything out about the hold?
No, I found nothing about the hold.
Okay, that's all.
He's telling the truth there, because he didn't even look.
Yeah.
Icy fingers crawled up Ronyos' spine, telling him that he was being watched. He turned to see the eyes of Bakai, the first mate, on him. It unnerved Ronyos that he could not tell how long the raven-haired man had been there, or how much he had heard. The dark eyes of the man betrayed nothing as he bowed in greeting. As he did whenever placed in an uncomfortable situation, Ronyos smiled, trusting in his inherent charisma. "It is Symok's wish to sup with you and your companions this evening." He and the Aesir's reaction must have been comical, judging by the quick smile of the ship's officer. "Do not look so surprised, my friends. Like many of his ilk, Symok detests dining alone. With our time together drawing to a close, he wishes to treat you to a fine meal. That is all." With a last nod at the silent pair, Bakai turns and walks away with a dangerous grace that Ronyos had failed to notice from the man until now. An unease rose in the Zamorian's guts. He realized that the raven-haired first mate was a deceptively dangerous man, warranting caution. He decided that he would hate this man from this point on. The white linen tablecloth that covered the center table glowed with the light of polished candle holders whose flickering burden stretched toward the ceiling like ivory talons from golden fingers. Lovaisa looked over everything with a sense of wonder. Civilized gatherings still vexed her, but she was tolerating them with growing familiarity, at least until now. To her, this setting was still too surreal. Dining like nobles aboard a ship, while slaves starved below, made her stomach turn. A stoop-backed man appeared from a staircase bearing a heavy silver platter topped with two freshly opened, twine-wrapped wine bottles. As the heady bouquet of the wine struck her, she spared a glance toward the closed door of the cabin that she shared with Nadia and Lalika. The little girl had retired earlier in the night, after the first course, complaining of a throbbing head. But she was sly, and Lovaisa would not be surprised if Lalika was eavesdropping, knowing that adults frequently held their tongues while children were present. She doubted she was a slumber even at this late hour. Her eyes turned to Symok, their host, who was enwrapped in close conversation with Nadia, as he had been all evening. His intent was obvious by his demeanor, which did not surprise Lovaisa. Many men seemed to lose their wits when Nadia was present. It was then that the Aesir felt eyes watching her. She turned her head to Ronios, who sat beside her, staring. Now that the Zamorian had her attention, he nodded in the direction of the captain. Lovaisa looked in the indicated direction, understanding the Zamorian's unspoken meeting. Just over the captain's left shoulder, a silver-mailed man stood vigil before the thick door leading to the captain's cabin.
Is this the door that I peeked into the window?
From the other side, yes.
Okay.
Throughout the dinner, the captain starts to almost exclusively speak to Nadia, to the point of being quite obviously rude to everyone else. You just see in his eyes, he's never quite seen somebody like that before. When you guys worked out the deal to travel with him, he never spoke of this little girl and this obviously exotically beautiful woman. But when he saw her, when you brought her aboard, he was like, oh, yes, definitely, just a little more money and you can do this. So now that she's up, moving around and whatnot, he is infatuated with her, even to the point where like he's leaning forward and just speaking to her, just filling her drink, leaving you guys to just kind of sit there amongst yourselves with the first mate.
I scowl at Lovaisa.
Okay.
It doesn't even register.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, this guy really likes him. That's really nice. That's cool.
Does anybody else feel this is incredibly awkward?
Well, but it's not like you're just sitting there in silence.
Right.
Okay, because the first mate is actually quite a jovial, outgoing guy. So he's very, very engaging. He says he was born and raised in Sultanapur. He became a sailor at a young age, and fairly boring story, but talks about the different ports and things like that. And each individual port he paints as a completely exotic land, completely unique, to the point where you're like, I would like to visit this place. That sounds really great.
I was going to say, I'm super intrigued because everything is exotic and new.
Exactly. He has you completely enthralled in this, in talking about his travels and the adventures that traveling on the sea has provided for him and whatnot. And then he starts talking about sailing north and how the islands to the north of the Viliette are really the only uncharted or unknown lands because no one really lives there. And so that's why you have the pirate problem that you have to the north, because there's a lot of coves and whatnot for ships to hide. But that's one of the reasons why we started venturing into deeper water, was to try and avoid some of these islands. He's very open about, you know, where he came from and what he does and the things that he knows. And then he turns the conversation towards you guys, wanting to know where you're from. First thing he says is, you're such a diverse group. How did you meet?
I saved these fools from a Zamorian spider god.
That's not how I would remember it at all.
I barely even got to the giant spider. I was being attacked by a bunch of naked orgy members. It was, you know, it was a deal. It doesn't matter.
You acquitted yourself quite poorly, as I recall.
Look, you know, I was a bit distracted by all the nakedness.
And not the giant spider?
The giant spider was disturbing, but again, on the other side of the temple, I was being attacked by naked people.
The first mate leans forward and he says, I beg your pardon?
Ronios and
So there was this temple full of people who were engaged in sexual activity. One of them had my thing.
Wait a minute.
My object. Not my Svanstika, my amulet. And I wanted it back. So Durand and I were going in to get it out.
Ronios and I were going in. We were employed by a friend.
Can we stop saying going in when referring to the orgy room, please?
We did go into the orgy room.
I understand, Ronios. But let's find a better term.
We were there to save Nadia.
Valak and I were there for a completely different reason.
We were looking for my amulet thing.
You went to a temple?
Yes.
Devoted to a spider god?
Yes.
unbeknownst to us until the spider god descended from ceiling, yes.
You start to regale this tale of spider gods and secret cults and magical...
Rescue the virgin as well.
Amulets. As you start talking about how you guys all met, and it turns out that Nadia was supposed to be the sacrifice to this spider god, the captain becomes instantly impressed by the fact that you saved this beautiful creature.
Quite by accident.
She like lifts up the side of her dress.
On purpose.
To show the scar on the side of her chest where the person trying to sacrifice her actually missed her as she moved out of the way.
I believe she was taken out of the way by this girl.
Virgins were rescued is the point.
This is why I said I'd explain later.
The captain smiles.
You saved this rare treasure? Then I am in your debt, for I have never seen one so lovely.
I look the captain dead in the eye and I say, I saved her twice.
Symak nods, taking the stout bottle and pouring the rich blood red wine into tall, broad, bold glasses for everyone to drink.
A toast to the great heroes.
Tiny sips set down.
Are you smellying the wine? It's the only wine available. You want to send it back?
I'll take a cue from Mark and make sure that I'm not being poisoned.
He poured it into his own glass, too. Unless it's iocane powder.
Right, in which case I'm immune.
The conversation goes on again, and he becomes more entranced with Nadia, and First Mate comments on how that's a wonderful story, and if only half of it's true, it still makes it a great tale. And, you know, he's a sailor. Sailors lie, so...
I'm not a sailor. I do not lie, unless I'm telling a lie. I certainly don't lie about that.
This is no fish tale, I assure you.
All right, he nods, and he says it's very very compelling, very compelling. And he says, are you on such an adventure now?
I certainly hope not. I'm over giant spiders as a concept.
I'm not sure where this road's going to take us.
Ship.
This ship. These waters.
He nods and says, well, it just seems quite strange that a group that would meet under such extraordinary circumstances are now on the ship that I serve on, and we're going into essentially uncharted waters.
I didn't know the waters were uncharted. Now that I know that, I'm a little concerned.
We are on the journey together. The destination is unknown.
I'm only concerned about finding my father, and I will travel anywhere.
Tell them too much.
I'm concerned with finding the other half of my thing. Amulet.
Your amulet is...
That.
So you found one part of your amulet in the spider temple, and now you're searching for the other part.
I've found, yes. Essentially, yes.
You get the distinct impression he's trying to figure out where the hell you guys are going. And in turn, where the hell he's going.
Man, we don't even know where the hell we're going. We just
apparently
go.
We're going somewhere uncharted.
Very well. He decides not to pry anymore.
This wine is very good, Symak. May I have a bottle of it to take with me?
Symak eyes Rinyard suspiciously.
Considering the amount of money I've paid for this trip, I would appreciate it greatly.
The Tyranian seaman eyes Rinyard for a long moment. Then, breaking the tension, Symak claps his hands, emitting a thunderous crack that reverberates loudly in the confined room. All eyes turn to the stoop-backed servant who appears at the top of the galley stairs.
Bring Lord Durand a bottle of wine to retire with.
I cannot quite place it, and since you have no markings on the bottle, I must ask, where did this fine vintage come from?
Eastern Zingara.
Does that sound right? Is the wine that good?
No. Zingaran wine would be very, very rare this far east. You get the distinct impression, though, that he's trying to impress Nadia.
Okay, I won't let on that I see through his lie.
Wax dribbles from the low-burning candles, coating the golden holders and now stained white linen tablecloth. Feigning melancholy, Ronios lingers at the table, slowly sipping his wine, while Symak and Nadia finish the last bottle on the table. Quick, harsh looks from the captain clearly tell the Zamorian that his presence was inhibiting the chances of the pot-bellied man luring Nadia into his cabin for the night. Ronios masks a smile. The others had long retired to their assigned berths. Even Lovaisa, whose stamina was greater than men twice her size, had abandoned her chaperone duty for the warm comfort of her padded rack. With a grunt of derision toward him, Symak stands, gathering Nadia's dainty hands in his thick ringed fingers, and lightly touches his lips to them before making his way past the guard at his door, finally surrendering his conquest attempt for the night. Ronios watches as Nadia gathers herself, stands, and walks slowly toward her latticework cabin door. Then she turns her head sidelong in his direction, a quick, appreciative grin flashing on her lips before she opens the door and disappears in the gloom beyond. Rising, Ronios glides to the door of his own cabin. Before he enters, he spares a glance at the armored man standing before the captain's door. The man remained unmoving as a statue. The Zamorian closes the door behind him as he enters the cramped cabin. In the dark, he sees the form of Rinyard sitting in his bunk, as if waiting for him. The light breathing to his left told that Valak was awake also.
Renyud, would you be opposed to the idea of figuring out the way into Captain's quarters?
Not at all.
Because I'm thinking we're close to our destination, yes? Well, I'm thinking, if we could figure out a way of quietly getting in there and quietly getting out, there's no way they could pin it on us. We could get money back plus some extra treasure.
I do not trust this man, Symok. He is unlike any ship's captain I've ever seen. He seems to have no real regard for his ship or crew. He leaves everything to this Bakai character. I am considering disposing of him when we arrive.
Why wait till we arrive?
He knows where the island is. We may as well let him take us there.
Okay.
Besides, it would be easier to assume the captaincy with the minds of the men on some ridiculous curse.
Who says you would be captain? I would make an excellent captain.
I know how to sail boat.
I do not particularly care who is captain as long as we have a way back.
I know how to sail boat, but I understand your concerns.
The first mate seems very interested in our destination. We should lure him and the captain ashore when we get there.
We would need some sort of distraction.
I can distract anyone.
Perhaps.
Let me think about it.
Having trust in his keen senses, which saved his life more than once, Ronyos awoke from a light sleep. Something was amiss, although he could not place it. Listening intently, he lay there hoping that whatever woke him would betray itself again now that he had his wits. A steady snore emanated from below him, telling that Valak was oblivious to the situation. A slight hiss to his right told the Zamorian thief that Renyard was awake also.
What Renyard and Ronyos hear that night is you hear a rattle of a door. Someone's testing a door, but you know distinctly it was not your door.
I get it.
Okay.
Look through the latticework and see what's going on.
Okay. What you see is three men standing outside of the lady's room, and one of them shaking the door as if testing it.
I'll rattle my door, try to scare them.
Two of them don't seem to be shaken, but one of them goes, the men are awake, hurry up, you fool. One of them, the closest to the door, says, give me your knife.
That's it, we take them out.
Wait, Ronyos, wait.
Why?
There is no hurry.
Lovaisa, someone touches you.
Oh.
You wake up, and it's Lalika. When you open your eyes, the moon's coming in through the portal, and you can see her in the moonlight. She's pointing at the door.
Lovaisa, wake up. Somebody's trying to break in.
And you turn and look, and you see the latch to the door. You see something pointing out through the crack and lifting the latch.
I spring up. I slept with my axe.
You grab for your axe. You start to sit up. Renyard, what you see is, as you're looking through there and you're rattling the thing, and you can tell the guy in the back's really spooked because he's like, you know... Coming from the door leading to the outside, onto the deck, you hear from that doorway a couple of voices go, well, hurry up then. Hurry up.
I reach over and wake the lock.
Poopy
I'm
trim.
Shoving Lalika and Nadia behind.
So you're standing in front of the two of them as this the door becomes unlocked.
I'm assuming Nadia is awake as well.
She is asleep.
Well,
she's drunk.
I turn to Ronyos and point to the porthole of the room. Go, you fool.
Okay, I get butter. I go.
How are you dressed there, Renyard?
I suppose I haven't had time to don my armor. Loincloth, I guess.
You feel somebody, like, shake you?
Poopy trim.
And you see Renyard is now standing at the door, peeking out. He had reached back and, like, grabbed your foot and shook it. And he's in his loincloth carrying his sword, and he's looking out.
Didn't do it!
Two hairy-faced seamen burst in, eyes glinting maliciously in the moonlight shining from the portal. In their hands shine the blades of vicious-looking long knives. One man stands behind them, blocking the doorway. His hand shakes as he points it in the direction of the adjacent cabin.
They're awake! They're awake!
Beyond the man at the door, voices murmur as a group of unseen men mutter drunkenly and then begin to laugh. Mid-morning sun beat down on the black-haired man as he rode a shaggy bay mare through the streets of Sultanapur. Rope, wrapped to his saddlebow, was attached to a second horse trailing his. On the back of this white great gelding rode a wild-eyed man bound about his torso with leather belts. The echo of the hooves on the cobblestones resonated down the deserted causeways of the city. Mattadai halted his mount. Looking at the rough brown buildings, they squatted on either side of the narrow avenue like stone toads with shuttered eyes. At this time of the day, even in this lower district, the streets should be crowded with people. He had seen none, save the north gate guards who reluctantly allowed his entrance. He tapped his heels to the mare's sides, and she began walking again. The ominous sound of the hooves returning to him, heralding his return to Sultanapur like a rhythmic dirge. Passing through the northern bazaar, normally bustling with commerce, the bonded took note of the vacant square with its closed awnings lining the walls. The few stalls that remained had dregs of rotten vegetables. Rats and other vermin were abundant, but no people or beasts of burden. Dismounting, he took up a handful of dung lying on the paves. The streets and bazaars normally were meticulously tended at night by sweepers and dung collectors, so the fact that it remained indicated that there had been no activity in the streets for a while. Judging by the sample in his hand, several days. Mattadai turns and looks at the man bound and strapped to the other horse. General Yama's bloodshot eyes bore into his with wild rage. There was no sign of the keen intellect that the man was renowned for, only the glaze of lunacy. Black blood stained his lips, his beard matted with filth and dried chunks of flesh, the remnants of when the man had chewed through his own tongue during their trip. Mattadai had attempted to stop the man, but was unable to, and received a nasty bite on his forearm for his trouble. The sooner he completed this contract, returning the general, the sooner he could collect Lovaisa from the palace, and they could resume their search for her father. The thought of the Aesir brought a smile to his lips. He felt fortunate that he had had the foresight to request that Nadia see to Lovaisa's safety while in Sultanapur. As sturdy a fighter as she was, in civilization she was more like a lost child. He felt a keen sense of responsibility for the girl. His mind distracted with the thoughts of Lovaisa, he didn't hear the ringing of hooves and the jingle of mail until it was too late. All he had time to do was remount his mare and turn in the direction of the approaching patrol. The column halted, seeing Mattadai and his charge for the first time. They were heavily armed, in long mail coats that covered them from shoulder to knees as they sat their mounts. Their gold-trimmed spiraled helms were wrapped in cloth of gold, the tails of which were wrapped around the faces of the riders, exposing just the eyes. This troubled Mattadai intensely. Adorned such meant that the soldiery was mourning, preparing for an attack and a war of vengeance, which explained the deserted streets. The bonded raised an empty hand to show the patrol that he posed no threat to them. With exaggerated caution, the lead horse turned sideways in the road as Mattadai approached, guiding his mare with his knees, one hand on the rope tethering to the general's horse, and leaving the other raised, open to the patrol. He noted with chagrin that the sergeant rested his hand on the hilt of his scimitar.
I bow to him. Sergeant, I am Mattadai of the Order of the Bonded. I'm here to deliver General Yama to the prince.
He nods. Very well. We will escort you. He turns his horse. The patrol separates so you could ride between them, and then they just turn and follow you.
Okay.
The sergeant is riding alongside you. The general is strapped to this other horse, and they don't even look at him. They're not questioning why you have this man bound or anything.
But they would know who he is, wouldn't they?
He doesn't really look like he normally... I mean, he's in tatters. He's covered in mud and blood. He's red-eyed. He's gnashing his teeth. He doesn't look like a noble general at all. He looks like you picked up a bum.
Okay. I'll turn to the sergeant and say, are you able to speak freely?
Eyes straight ahead, doesn't say a word.
Very well, then.
They escort you down the street. The clack of the horse's hooves is the only thing you hear. You do see birds and things like that, so it's not like this place is completely devoid of life. It's just devoid of activity at this point. You do see other mounted patrols occasionally. Your first assumption would be a city this size...
Looks like it's under martial law.
It's under lockdown. Something happened.
In my travels, this is not the first time this has happened.
Right, and usually it's like an impending attack.
It's a precursor to war.
Something like that. So they escort you to the palace. And as you ride up, the patrol sergeant goes forward and speaks to the two palace guard who are standing outside the gate, turns and motions for you to approach. And as you start to approach, he peels off, and then he and the patrol line up behind you and watch you go to the palace gates. The palace guard are standing there. They've got their usual spike-crested helms wrapped in cloth of gold with tails that are wrapped around their face also. Curved blades are tucked into wide cloth of gold girdles. They hold long-handled spears, and the spears are not ornamental at all. And they look like they're war spears.
Okay.
And then the wide blue pantaloons they wear, and then the curled tip shoes. They're standing there, and they're watching you approach, their eyes locked right on you. It would be customary for you to get off your horse and approach them. They just stand there as you approach. They don't move.
Okay. Is there a clear ranking officer?
Not with
them?
These guys, but they would just be, you know, guardsmen. Normally, they would step aside and just open the door for you, but they are standing right in your way.
Okay. Well, again, I'll address myself to them. It's like, bid you good day. I am Mattadai of the Order of the Bonded. And here I have in tow the prince's cargo, of which I was contracted to retrieve.
One of them nods, turns, and wraps onto the door, and then turns back and faces you. Within a few moments, the door cracks open, and you see a guard sergeant step out, and he says, I will take your cargo, my lord. Please wait here.
I just nod.
And he grabs the horse's reins of the general, and he slowly walks the general in the door.
Careful with that one. He is a sign of things to come.
Yeah, as the general goes by, like, he's strapped to the horse, and as he goes by the other two guards standing there, he's like actively trying to bite them. After a few moments, a wizened old man in white and gold robes, long white beard, he's old and craggy, steps out and nods. You recognize him as Zahra, and Zahra is the prince's vizier.
Okay.
So essentially his second in command.
Good day to you, Shaheen Baloosh.
I bow. And to you, sir.
You departed Sultanapur with considerably more men than you returned with.
You are correct.
A concern. What is the status of the cataphracts that escorted you north?
I kind of look around at the guards and I say, this conversation might be more suited for closed doors.
He nods.
Please, Bandit, indulge my curiosity.
I'll lay the whole thing out from beginning to end. Before dawn on the third day, the caravan was ambushed in the night and apparently wiped out to a man.
Yet you survived.
Yet I survived.
What of the prisoner or your companions? What became of them?
The prisoner, your intelligence was folly. Your prisoner was the wolf.
He doesn't seem too shaken by that information. He nods as if understanding.
Mm-hmm. My two companions were left bleeding, and I helped nurse them back to health. And then the wolf, in exchange for his freedom, gave me your general.
I see. And where are your friends now?
I left them with the wolf.
For what means?
To do whatever they choose.
A Solteranian agent allowed to leave Kozaki lands unmolested. Very strange.
I know not why or how.
He nods.
Very well.
But I fear the wolf is not your concern. It is that thing in there that you have now.
His black eyes harden as they focus on Mattadai. What concerns me, sir, is loyalty, or the lack of it. Zahra turns his back on the bonded and wraps the knob knuckles of his right hand on the stout engraved door to the palace. It opens to reveal a score of mailed palace guard, war spears pointing at the chest of the Shaheen Baloosh as they move to surround him. Where is the woman that you traveled with, Mattadai?
It has been months since I've traveled with a woman.
A white-haired woman of alien race has slain His Highness, Prince Dorixis, and his son, Nikifor.
Not that she's not capable, but I find it hard to believe.
Were you not so esteemed, you would die where you stand. For the sake of the crown and his interests, we must ascertain if your conditioning has been broken.
I look at him and say, that is simply not possible.
I will only ask this once. Will you surrender yourself to the king's justice?
I nod to my horse. I mean, I am unarmed. Everything I have is on the horse.
Okay. One of the guards steps forward and grabs the reins of your horse.
Your compliance will be taken into account with regards to your treatment. The wizened man turns on a sandaled heel and quickly steps inside while the guards behind Mattadai urge him to follow with the points of their broad-bladed spears.
Okay.
You are led to a very nice tower cell. You're not thrown in the dungeons. You're put into a tower cell, which is usually reserved for noblemen. So sure. Your status as a bonded afforded you this courtesy. Beyond that, there's not much to the room other than a bed and maybe a desk. You're given food 3 times a day, and you're allowed to write and things like that. Granted, you don't attempt to escape. If you attempt to escape, then you would be thrown into the actual dungeon.
Right, it's just meditation and waiting, biding my time.
And you do have a window, so you can see outside. You see that the streets are constantly being patrolled, and there's not been a whole lot of trade. You can see from this vantage point, you can actually see down to the docks. You can see the slave markets. The docks are locked down, and the slave markets, there's nothing going on. The only thing that you see is there are 2 warships just outside of port and look like that they're actively blocking anything that comes in. But you're not given any information as to what happened, why they even said Lovaisa did this, or anything. You're just taken here, and 3 days later, you're still there.
You know, in that time, you have plenty of time when you're in a cell, so I start replaying all the events over and over in my mind, like going back to my original suspicion of why was I not allowed to carry out this mission in a fashion which I normally would, which would be by myself. Why was I accompanied? Right. All of these things start playing back in my mind. So right.
3 days later, the lock to your door opens up, and Zahra comes in. And this is the first time you've seen anybody but a guard who's been giving you food, and a maid who comes in and changes your linens and things like that.
I'll move as to offer him, you know, a seat on the bench or whatever.
Behind him is a man that you recognize, Hamid. He's the king of Tehran's ambassador to Zamora. You had met him a year before in the presence of Prince Nikifor. Zahra just steps to the side, and Hamid takes one step into the room, looks at you.
I have seen this man before. He and his companions were welcome guests in the home of Nikifor when His Highness last visited Zamora.
I acknowledged that, yes.
And
I nod.
And Hamid nods.
His company included the Northron savage who killed our lord.
Zahra nods. The ambassador turns and just walks straight out. Zahra stands there.
I'm afraid that your association with the murderer has condemned you.
I nod to him. I understand. It appears the treachery in this house runs deep.
It is my duty, as steward of Sultanapur, to order your execution. As befits the crime, it must be held in public forum. I am sorry, Madadai.
Yes.
He nods to you.
Say, can you afford me one question?
Go ahead.
What of the fate of Kai Sharan? His body was not found at the site of the slaughter, and he was sent to accompany me.
It was assumed that when word of the massacre reached Sultanapur, that he fell with the rest. Are you saying that that was not the case?
Could not find his body.
I see.
Curious, that?
The matter will be investigated, I assure you. Looking at Madadai in the eyes for a moment, Sarah shakes his head. A look of disappointment crosses his face, and he turns toward the door. When he reaches for the latch, he turns, and he looks at the bandit over his shoulder. There is one other who wishes to see you this evening.
Very well.
He closes the door, and within a few minutes, there's a rap on the door. It opens, and the commander of the Shaheen Baloosh, your fraternity within the bonded, steps in. His name is Mahood.
I smile, father.
He steps in. He's a middle-aged man, very long mustache, almost like Fu Manchu long. Mm-hmm. He's got a shaved head with a long gray topknot. He looks at you with his hawk-like eyes.
I look to him and say, the company we keep.
He doesn't seem very pleased with you, just with his expression.
This woman, this Aesir woman.
Yes.
Did she break you?
No, father. Have you ever known me to falter?
No. Though your association with foreigners and other alien creeds may have had an unforeseen effect on you, making you susceptible to heathen charms.
I smile. She was a breath of fresh air, needed after a long journey. But her cause was worthy of our order, and I believe it still is.
Mahood stares at Madadai, unmoved. I am profoundly saddened by these turns of events, my son. Never in 400 years has the honor of the bonded been questioned. Until now.
I do not hold those questioning in a high regard.
You put me in a difficult position, Madadai. My love for you must not overshadow obligation.
I understand. That's why I go willing to my fate, whatever it be.
Regardless of your place in this foul plot, the fact remains that justice must be served, even if that means my last son must die. Reflect this night so that you may unburden your soul.
Aye, I understand.
Mahood's eyes glisten with unshed tears as he turns toward the door.
As he walks away, I say, a storm is coming, Father.
Silver moonlight shines through the lone, narrow window of the tower's cell as Matadai sits his stool brooding. In the hours since Mahood left, his mind raced. His father used the words foul plot. It was not simply a case of a turn of phrase. Mahood weighed everything he said and did. He was suggesting that the prince and his son were not merely murdered, but assassinated. Then there were his last words to him. Unburden your soul. A bonded term used to release them from their obligation, or to absolve them of the guilt of their actions done during their service. So intent on his own thoughts, Matadai almost didn't hear the turning of the lock of the door. He composes himself, while he watches the door slowly open.
That's peculiar.
Stepping in is a man in a plain gray robe, hooded robe. He walks in and does not close the door behind him. You are Matadai.
Hi.
May I sit?
Please.
The gray-robed man sits, lowering his hood to expose his angular-featured face. He is Hyborian, Aquilonian, if Matadai had to venture a guess. His shaved pate and face glisten with sweat as he settles on the corner of the bed. His kindly blue eyes take in the room and then turn to the bonded, a slight grin on his thin lips.
I've never spoken to a bonded before, and it is my honest pleasure to speak to you, especially one belonging to the Shaheen Baloosh.
I am still just a man.
My name is Hadrathus.
Cyclot.
You've never heard of this guy before.
I smile. The pleasure is mine.
I am here because there are those who understand the... And he kind of, like he's looking for the correct turn of phrase. And he says, your place in the coming storm.
I just think of Mofir. Sounds like something he would say.
Yes. I am of the Order of Asherah.
Matadai recoils at the mention of the forbidden cult. The Order of Asherah was widely persecuted in Tehran, and associating with them meant death. But considering his current situation, that mattered little. This man, this Hadrathus, risked much by exposing himself in such a manner. All it took was one yell from the bonded's lips, and this man would be taken out in chains, if he was fortunate. Mahood's words echoed in his head again. Alien creeds. Matadai looked to the door, which Hadrathus had left ajar. He could see the partially obscured form of the guard in the stairwell. He decided to hear what Hadrathus had to say.
There are others who know about your friends and those you associated with, and that forces are drawing them to the north.
To the tower?
He nods.
Because I was present for that talk before I left.
Yes, with the mention of the Tower of the Ape.
Yeah.
And Hadrathus says, yes, to the north. In the Tower of the Ape. There's a keen interest in stopping Aura from his task. Now you don't know what he's talking about. He leans forward. He says, there are some that you have associated with in the past who have contact or have a history. The man who is now orchestrating all of this. It is imperative that he not succeed in what he's trying to do. The man who goes by the name of Aura is actually not what he seems. He is a powerful wizard who has come up from the south and acquired an item of power, which he is trying to make whole. If he is allowed to do this, it is the fear of the Order of Asherah as well as our allies that none can stand before him.
A companion of mine warned me of this coming storm, a troubled mind, but I couldn't help but believe him. And seeing you here certainly weighs heavily on my mind. I stroke my beard, look at the open door, and I ask him, do you have a contract for me?
He smiles. He says, I do, if you would take it.
So long as I can walk, I will carry out this contract.
He nods. Go to the Tower of the Ape and stop Aura from joining the gem.
Gem. Knew a man with a gem once. Thinking about, because I didn't really spend a whole lot of time with Mark's character.
Not really, but you do know that before you guys split up, yeah, I mean, he was very open about finding this gem that was stolen from him.
His thing.
You have accepted my contract, so you will see it through. He says, you will follow me, and I will show you to a swift horse so that you can carry this out.
Okay.
He stands up and he turns and looks at you. You do realize, and he looks at the door and then back at you, what this possibly means to you.
I do. I have effects and things. You said I was able to write. And
yeah.
I leave a note saying my execution will have to be delayed, for I have a contract I must fulfill.
As they step through the door, the guard on the stairwell turns his back on them, obviously so he could not see his captive escape. They weren't five steps down when he heard the door to his cell close and the key turn in its lock. Hadrathis leads him down several flights of marble steps before entering a shadowed side hall. When the gloom turns to absolute darkness, the Ashran grabs Madadai's hand and places it on his robed shoulder so that the smaller man could guide him. His confident steps told the bonded that this man had traversed this darkness many times. Dizzingly descending spiral stairs, the two increase their pace until they reach the bottom. Hadrathis is suddenly silhouetted in moonlight as he opens a door in the small landing, a door to the outside. A snort in the night catches Madadai's attention as he crosses the threshold of the outer door. He turns and sees a horse tethered to a low railing. He steps to the gray gelding and rubs its nose. Inspecting the gear fastened to it, he nods in appreciation. Whoever packed this kit did so with the expertise of a mule skinner. The bonded smiles as he mounts, noting the fine Hyrcanian bowcase strapped to the saddle with a falcon sigil branded to it. He rests his hand on the heirloom and gives Hadrathis an appreciative nod. The Asheron returns the nod and smiles. Then, without a word, he turns and steps back into the palace, closing the door behind him. Madadai's eyes dilate in surprise as he notes that, when closed, the door was not discernible from the rest of the surrounding wall.
I have a pretty good handle of this city, so I'll make the most expedient exit.
Madadai turns his mount north and slowly rides. Fully expecting to be halted by the guards manning the north gate, he was in no particular hurry to get cut down. His trip through the nighted city is swift, only sounds of the night to greet him. On one occasion, he heard the clatter of a mounted patrol, but he did not see them. He viewed the north gate well before he approached it. As he neared, his mouth opened in surprise. The gate stood open. No guards in sight.
Friends in high places.
Seizing the opportunity, he digs his heels into the horse's flanks, urging the beast forward at increasing speed until he tears through the opening at a full gallop, his cloak flapping in the deepening dark. Listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of Tower of the Ape. Please check for further episodes on our website, gamerstable.com. Any use of this production for commercial purposes is prohibited. Written credit for music and other properties used in this production can be found on this episode's dedicated webpage. Conan is the property of Conan Properties International, who have graciously allowed us to make this production. Savage Worlds Deluxe is the property of Pinnacle Entertainment Group. Openly Gamer Theater and Gamer's Table are trademark properties of Side Tangent Productions.